Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, while the world is rightly focused on the slaughter and starvation taking place in Gaza, there are still many, many other parts of our planet desperately in need of help. And this is running in parallel with a reduction in aid commitments from many countries in the developed world, something that's having a direct effect on the health and lives of millions of people. Dominic McSorley is Humanitarian Ambassador for Concern Worldwide. Dominic, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Could you give us... We know about Gaza, obviously, that's in the news every day. What other parts of the world are being kind of, shunted at the periphery in terms of our attention?
Many, unfortunately. And we've seen a rise of conflict-driven hunger in particular. Gaza's on the news, but Sudan today is the world's largest hunger crisis.
Yeah.
You can point to Yemen, you can talk to Burkina Faso, you can look at Haiti. And it's a combination of climate-driven crisis and conflict.
Yeah.
And we're now at a stage where there are an estimated 300 million people across the globe that need urgent life-saving assistance.
Yeah, and Darfur, I read, is Darfur used to be at the top of the headlines and then almost completely forgotten about.
I worked in Darfur 20 years ago and I went back last year and I thought it was bad 20 years ago. I was shocked at what I saw. And the images that we're seeing, the horrific images we're seeing coming out of Gaza, I saw every day. In fact, worse.
Yeah.
And this is out of the spotlight. And, you know, the thing is, just because it's not on the media doesn't mean to say that there's a crisis happening. And honestly, I kind of feel that there was a massive movement in Darfur to end the genocide there.
Yeah.
We had George Clooney, we had everybody in there. And now we're hearing nothing. We've got a lot going on in Gaza, which is really, really important. But we've got to start focusing on some of the... And the main thing we have to do is push at a political leadership level for an end to these conflicts.
Yeah. Now, obviously the Trump administration has been a huge influence in this. But even before, is it fair to say, even before he took office, there were developed countries reducing their aid budget?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen for the first time in 30 years, overseas development assistance has been cut back. So for the last 2 years, you have France, Germany, the UK and the US, some of the biggest donors in the world, reducing their overseas development assistance. And in terms of humanitarian assistance, that's reducing as needs are rising. So the UN estimates that of those 300 million people, if they get enough money, they can reach maybe 114. So we're condemning two-thirds of those people, almost half of those people who are not yet at death's door.
Mm.
And they will become the urgent needs of tomorrow. So frankly, my view of this is we're spending more on war than we are in peace. We're spending more on bullets than we are on bread. And when you look at what's been spent annually on arms trade, it's in the trillions in comparison to what is required to keep 300 million people alive.
Yeah. Why is this? No, I would imagine governments probably have always spent more on war than they have on peace. But the shift away, that countries find it, I suppose, politically acceptable in their own countries to reduce their overseas aid budgets. Why is that happening?
I think there's a number of factors. You know, and COVID, you know, there was much more money being spent, certainly in the global north in relation to that. I think the second thing is we've seen a kind of shift in governments. You know, even under a couple of years ago, under the Conservative government in the UK, the UK aid was slashed. I think we lost something like 8 million in 1 year. But I think what's very worrying in the last 12 months and going forward is now this increase of towards 5% on defence budgets. And we can see that most of the European countries are now going to be moving. Now, whether Europe needs to defend itself may be one thing, but to cannibalise aid budgets to transfer that to me is totally unacceptable.
Mm, yeah, they're not here to say whether that's a direct transfer or not. I suppose one could infer things from those figures. I wonder, is it also within Europe and many parts of the world, there's a rightward shift in terms of politics in general? So suddenly it's become more acceptable to say, no, we won't give. We won't send aid to people in other parts of the world. We have to look after ourselves.
Yeah, that absolutely. Kind of, and it's short-sighted. You know, we had the head of UNHCR, Filippo Grandi, was here a couple of days ago. His one message to Ireland, the Irish government and the Irish people is stay the course. right? Ireland has always prioritized aid. It's recognized, you know, the consequences of famine, the consequences of conflict, and it's in its foreign policy, and it has stayed true to that. While other European countries now, against domestic politics and political self-interest, are cutting back. And we live in an interconnected world. And if we ignore the problems over there, they will for sure become our own problems.
Yeah. I suppose part of that rightward shift also is a distrust of the idea of a globalised world and a distrust of NGOs. That they're all a part of this kind of new mindset we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, this is the rhetoric that has been spun out and challenging around efficiency and effectiveness. And the thing is, you know, you would love these people to spend 10 minutes in Gaza or 15 minutes in Darfur and say, pull the plug.
Yeah.
Pull the plug on food for mothers that cannot feed their children. Pull the plug on schools and education where kids are going to grow up without any prospects of getting decent jobs. Pull the plug on protection programs where women, you know, are being safely sheltered away from harm, violence and rape. You know, that to me is the much bigger issue around the fact that until these wars and until there's a greater commitment for what the world has signed up to, the sustainable development goals, a world without hunger, a world where wars shouldn't exist. It sounds pie-eyed and idealistic. It's not.
Now, specifically, though, while a lot of governments have been doing this, I imagine that the effect of basically eradicating USAID has had a profound effect on concern on all sorts of organisations operating.
It's been devastating. I mean, the US government was the largest contributor to the aid programme, probably about 40%. And that has been stripped away from the UN agency, stripped away from international NGOs. I mean, I think concern, you know, we've always had this kind of conservative policy about how much we take from one donor. And we have never taken more than 30% from any one donor. So that's kind of protected us. And we didn't lose all our US government funding, but we lost quite a lot of it. I think the second thing that's protected us, the public has always been among our biggest donor. And that's something we cherish. That's something we work hard to maintain our reputation. But not all agencies have had that. I can tell you something. You know, we've had to close programs in a number of countries as a result of this. And between USAID and other donors, the light is being switched off on life-saving programs across the globe, and it is devastating.
Yeah. And is there an alternative? Like, I mean, and I imagine many organizations were then scrabbling around looking for alternative sources of funding. Are they there? They're probably really hard to come by now.
They're very hard to come by. I think the private sector, you know, Bill Gates came out with a new announcement. He wants to spend his $200 billion now in the next few years. So there's a long line of people trying to access that level of funding. I think the private sector has got off very lightly. You know, they're very, very reluctant to invest in places like Sudan or in other contexts. They need to get a grip. We need to see much more investment by the private sector. There are other donors that are emerging, you know, in Saudi Arabia, in the Middle East and things. They're not easy money to access, but we have to do our best to do that. And again, public support. The public is outraged at what is happening in Gaza. The public wants to support, but they also want to see an end at the highest political level.
Yeah. And I suppose that it'd be, somebody's texting in to say, tell us in no uncertain terms where aid has stopped a conflict, which perhaps slightly missing the point of what you're saying, I would think. On that cooperation on an international level, is the UN now effectively useless?
I mean, there's the UN agencies, right, which are very operational on the ground, and then there's the United and the Security Council.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, you know, the UN was established, let's remember, it turns 80 this year, and it's having lots of kind of ceremonies. And we're hoping that it is going to revisit what it was set up for in the first place after two world wars. Prevent war, preserve human rights, and accelerate development. In Gaza, Sudan, and many other countries, it's failing on all three fronts.
Mm.
And I think the fact that, you know, the permanent five, which is a reflection of the world as it was coming out of World War II, are still the ones that are holding all the cards, still have the veto where they can block calls for ceasefire, calls for whatever. This is outdated. And this needs to be radically changed. And I think certainly Ireland has been pushing, and many other smaller nations have been pushing, for a reform of the UN that will be more inclusive and able to do what it should be doing.
That reform would involve the agreement of the five permanent members of the Security Council.
I mean, that's a challenge. And, you know, the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has some workarounds. You know, you can no longer block a veto and just not explain it. Now, if you want to put a veto in there, you have to publish your reasons why. And there are 10 days within which other member states. But, you know, frankly, I don't think it's enough. I think the veto needs to go.
Yeah. No, I think probably many countries would agree with you. But the, is there anything like a practical strategy there to get rid of that veto? Is there, you know, is there any political means where perhaps all the smaller countries in the world, is there a head of steam to try and force them out of that position?
Yeah, I think Ireland actually had played that role really well when it was on the Security Council. When it went up to blockages and this kind of stuff, it started to form coalitions with other like-minded smaller organisations. There's a huge power if you can get smaller nations to come together, as Ireland has done very effectively. Mm. So let's not underestimate the influence that smaller countries can have at that political level. But ultimately, you know, it's in all of our hands. Protests need to continue, writing to our own governments. I think it's not just the UN. I think we need to start hearing and holding the EU, the other great centre of influence, to account for what is not happening in relation to ending conflict and what is not happening in relation to providing life-saving assistance.
Given that it was the United States that was providing such a huge bulk of the aid budget for so many organisations, I'm surprised, why wasn't the EU providing similar amounts? Why isn't it filling up that gap now?
Yeah, well, the EU has always been, I mean, you know, we were receiving probably about 25, 30 million a year from the EU consistently. And but again, the EU is made up of member states, and they are the ones who vote in budgets. And I think this is what we're seeing, is kind of self-interest from different political leadership within the EU, within different parts of the world, is championing that over and ignoring. You know, people talk, is there compassion fatigue? There isn't compassion fatigue, not when you see what people are so outraged about what's happening. It's not compassion fatigue, but there is political marginalization and self-interest that is refusing then to make the hard call in relation to supporting humanitarian assistance and driving political solutions.
Dominic, you've been working in this area an awful long time. How do you keep going without getting utterly, without giving in to despair?
Well, you can't. And I've never been cynical about this. And, you know, the thing is, like, I worked in Rwanda after the genocide. I stood there and I said, I do not believe that this country will find its feet again with the level of bloodshed, with the level of horror that was there within my lifetime. I returned 15 years later and the place had been transformed. Wars end, conflicts end. We have to remember that when we look at places like Sudan and Gaza. And the one thing I will say, I've been privileged to work in places where you see the extraordinary transformation. When you work with communities, when there is access, when there is resources at family level, at community level, at regional level, you know, people will rise up with resilience when given the space to do that. And there is nothing more inspiring. And that's what we have to hold on to.
Dominic, thanks a million for coming in to talk to us today. That was the Humanitarian Ambassador for Concern Worldwide, Dominic McSorley.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.